next case on the court's calendar this morning is Brisson versus State of Minnesota. We're ready for oral arguments. Would each attorney please be sure to state his name for the record before each leg of the arguments?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Zorislav Lederman. I represent Natalie Brisson. Ms. Brisson had a case in Ramsey County District Court. It was dismissed in two phases. Initially, the District Court dismissed Ms. Brisson's state tort claims against the Department of Corrections under Rule 12. Later on, the court dismissed the remaining Human Rights Act claim for sexual discrimination, sexual harassment under Rule 56. We're challenging both of those dismissals and asking for.
I know that you sent a request that we postpone this case because our Sterry decision, and it seems that Sterry, because it's precedential, takes care of your first argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe the Department of Corrections will disagree with that, but they'll let us know. They may disagree with the rationale, and I think they've they've appealed at PFR. Did I haven't seen that the Supreme Court has decided whether to take it or not. So could you focus on your second, your Rule 56?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't even have any notes about the first issue, so if the court had a question, I was going to just go off memory.
That was a softball.
Yes. I will focus, Your Honors, on this issue with regards to the Minnesota Human Rights Act and how that applies to this case, and that was my plan for today. District Court decided to apply case law from the employment statute 363.8.08. Numerous cases for over many years discussing how to apply incidents of sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual discrimination in a case of employment. This is a public services case, it's not an employment case. And so I think we have to start by distinguishing the two different contexts where sexual misconduct can occur. And I want to make sure that the court understands our position. We're not advocating for this court to apply some standard to any case of public services. This case focuses specifically on the correctional context. And the question is, how do we apply the statute within the context of a correctional officer who sexually abuses or sexually assaults an inmate in their custody? And so in employment context, you have employees who apply for a job voluntarily. They show up for work and they work for the employer. This is a very different situation as compared to an inmate who doesn't have their freedom. They have to follow the rules. They are required to do what the officer tells them. And then the officer essentially takes them for a ride and sexually assaults them and tells them that if you tell anyone, you're going to get in trouble. This is a very different context than what you have in an employment setting. So I think we have to start with the understanding that you can't simply take employment case law and transfer it into a situation that's completely different. Point number two, we have to look at the statutes, Your Honor, because the statutes are also not the same. If the public services statute had identical text to the employment statute under the Human Rights Act, then perhaps these arguments would make sense, that we simply transfer over this developed body of case law from the employment context into the sexual harassment under the public services context. But the statutes are also not the same. So under the employment statute, 363A.08, statute says it is an unfair employment practice for an employer to discriminate against a person with respect to hiring, tenure, et cetera. And I want to point out the term employer because 363A.08 specifically identifies the employer as a liable party, and the employer can be liable for discriminating against an employee. Then we go down to, and I'll also note that this.
Interrupt you at this
yes,
point.
Yes, sir.
There is the City of Minneapolis versus Richardson case, and it's a race discrimination claim under the same statute, MHRA.
Yes.
And it seems to have a two-part or two-prong first step and a finding that, I'm going to read from it, a finding that an unfair discriminatory practice has occurred may be made when the record establishes, one, an adverse difference in treatment with respect to public services of one or more people. I don't think you're saying that one applies, but you may be saying that two applies. Treatment is so at variance with what reasonably would be anticipated absent discrimination that discrimination is the probable explanation.
Your Honor, yes, we would argue that that second definition applies, but I'm familiar with the case, Your Honor. And the issue in that case wasn't so much whether the city of Minneapolis should be held liable for its employees' misconduct for race discrimination. The issue in that case is how do you establish that race discrimination occurred? And so the court in that case set out these two standards for how to decide whether you even have an act of discrimination by an employee of the city. And so, yes, the case is somewhat applicable, Your Honor, but again, our position is that the specific issue in this case of whether strict liability applies to the employer based on the employee's sexual misconduct or acts of discrimination, that wasn't considered, from my understanding, at length in that decision regarding the city of Minneapolis. So then we look to the statute, Your Honors, regarding public services. This is 363A.12. And the statute says that it's an unfair discriminatory practice to discriminate against any person in the access to, admission to, full utilization of, or benefit from any public service. And so here we don't have this pinpointed direction at the employer. The statute simply says that it's an unfair discriminatory practice to discriminate against a person based on various categories. And so the court considered a similar issue in the Bray case, which is cited in our briefing, Bray versus Starbucks, where that was a public accommodations case against Starbucks, where Starbucks was attempting also to do the same thing that the state is doing here, is to apply employment cases to the public accommodation cases. And even though Bray is not published, we don't have a whole lot of published case law on this particular issue from this court or the Supreme Court. And so,
if we were to make it presidential, what would the syllabus point be?
The syllabus point B would be, Your Honor, is that under 363A.12, the statute means what it says, because the statute applies strict liability. And again, the focus in this case isn't for all cases. The focus in this case is on incidents of sexual abuse within the correctional context. And the syllabus should say is that the statute applies strict liability. That's what the legislature intended, and that's how the statute should be interpreted. There is case law. We don't deny that there is a lot of case law in the both federal and state case law within the employment context that does require notice to the employer in situations where an employee experiences sexual harassment or sexual abuse at work. However, even under that standard, this flows from the federal standard, there is an exception, Your Honors, for cases involving sexual misconduct that is perpetrated by supervisors or supervisory employees. Both this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has discussed this exception at length in a number of cases. I'll just cite the three. We have Kay versus Peter Motor Company. This is 483 Northwest 2D481. Then we have, this is a Court of Appeals case from 1992. We have the Friedler versus Carlson Marketing Group case. Supreme Court decision 751 Northwest 2D558 from 2008. And then we also have the McNabb versus Cup Foods decision, 352 Northwest 2D378, Supreme Court opinion from 1984.
So the state argues that they're entitled to official immunity?
Your Honor,
it was a discretionary, not a ministerial decision to have one correctional officer do the transport.
Right.
It may have changed, but what's your response to that?
Our response, Your Honor, is that we're not challenging the state's policy in this case. We're not challenging the Department of Corrections policy as being discriminatory in the fact that it permits one officer to transport one offender or one inmate. So we're not making the argument that the policy itself is discriminatory. We're making the argument that Officer Beeler, in this case, discriminated and sexually harassed Ms. Brisson during the transport, and that act in its own is an act of sexual discrimination. And so the issue of official immunity is not relevant because we're not using that theory to build the case. Going back to what I was saying, Your Honors, regarding this supervisor exception, we would argue that in a context of corrections, if you have a correctional officer and an inmate interacting with each other, that is no different than a supervisor and an employee interacting in an employment setting. And in fact, a supervisor in an employment setting has much less power over an employee than a correction officer does over an inmate when it comes to corrections. Because in an employment setting, even though there is an imbalance of power between supervisors and employees, the employee is still free to leave, exit the situation, quit, walk out without any sort of criminal repercussions or freedom-related repercussions. In a correction setting, Ms. Brisson didn't have a choice to leave. She could not leave. She was in his custody. She was required to follow the rules. And so even if we were to apply this federal standard of requiring some kind of notice, we do have an exception even under the federal standard with regards to situations where the perpetrator of the sexual discrimination or sexual harassment is a supervisor. And if that's the case, then the perpetrator's actions are imputed to the employer. And so even under the federal case law, there is still strict liability in situations where there is an extreme, number one, imbalance of power, and number two, where the employee who conducts or who engages in sexual misconduct has supervisory duties over the employee. And that is no different than what we have in this case. And specifically, the Friedler case. This is the 751 Northwest 2D 558 case. It quotes the McNabb decision, and it says, in McNabb versus Cup Foods, we held that it seems to be a clear legal conclusion that an employee's knowledge of acts of sexual harassment should be imputed to the employer because the employee was clothed with supervisory and managerial authorities over subordinates. That, Your Honors, is no different than a situation between Officer Beeler and Ms. Brisson, or between any other corrections officer who manipulates and then sexually abuses an inmate during a transport or during any other sort of a situation that arises in a correctional setting. That's all I had today, Your Honors. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer questions, but I don't have any further arguments on this issue.
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Joe Weiner, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the respondents, the State of Minnesota, the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and Commissioner Paul Snell. Probably not going to come as a surprise to the Court that we believe that this Court should affirm the entirety of the District Court's decision, including on the tort claims. But to the extent that the Court's really interested right now in the MHRA claim, I can start with that piece of it.
Do you think that Sterry controls?
I think that there's two reasons why it doesn't in this case. First, as a factual matter, even if this Court were to apply the common law standard of scope of employment, the Sterry case and this case are factually, based on the pleadings, distinguishable. Specifically, the focus of the Court in Sterry was that the individual, the plaintiff in that case, was ordered into a cooler as part of the job duties, and something that the officer could require that person to do, and also that the officer conducted a search, which was within the scope of that person's responsibilities. In this case, Officer Beeler, the actions involve a very separate, you can just delineate the situation much better in this case. The lawful assignment in this case with Officer Beeler was the transport of Ms. Brisson. What happened during that transport was that Officer Beeler stopped for food on the way, which was clearly a violation of policy. He purchased food for Ms. Brisson, which was also a violation of policy. And then he stopped the car, undid her restraints in the back, and brought her up to the front so that he could engage in the misconduct that he engaged in. And that is all outside of the scope of what that employment is. And in that sense, I think it's much closer to the Doe 175 case, where you have a situation with a teacher who maybe did not have a direct relationship with that person, the student, but did have that student come into that area because of his role as a teacher, and then use that authority that he had to abuse her. And so I think that, if anything, this case is more close to the Doe 175 case than to Sterry. So in that sense, I would distinguish it there as well. If I have time at the end, I'll also talk a little bit about why I think that the court maybe should reconsider Sterry, but I'll leave that for a later time.
Maybe the Supreme Court who will do that.
I understand.
So you want to save your words.
Yeah. So I will turn now, unless there's any further questions about the distinction between Sterry and the facts in this case, to the MHRA issue. Okay.
Can I just clarify, Mr. Weiner, though, you ignored the facts of the driving, the conduct later while he's driving. Would you agree that your distinction falls apart at that point while he's transporting her?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if he was transporting her in the back, which is what he's required to do and what policy says that he's required to do, it would be one thing. If he's saying things to her, if he's sexually harassing her verbally as she's in the back and doing that situation, I think that's one thing. In this situation where he pulls her out into the front of the car, I do think that creates a distinction between both the Sterry case and closer to what we see in the Doe case. In terms of the MHRA claim, I think that the text, the legislative history, and the purpose of the MHRA all support the inclusion of a should-have-known standard and move against the idea of strict liability in the MHRA context. I think the first place to start, something that has been very clear from the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they say this in the Freiler case, the MHRA, whether we're talking about the employment context, whether we're talking about public accommodations, housing, or in this case, public services, the MHRA is not a strict liability statute. That parallels the federal law on Title VII, and as it relates to the Meritor case, which is what Freiler was largely relying on in that situation. I think that, as we see, the purpose always is to effectuate the intent of the legislature. And what we see is, in 2000, the federal court decided the Longin case, where it was a public services case, and the court rejected the application of the knows or should have known standard to a public services case. And the reason they did that was because the text of the Minnesota Human Rights Act at the time made it very clear that the know and or should have known standard applied only to the employment piece of the statute. The following year, the legislature revised the statute, removed that language, specifically that it relates to employment. And the House research summary that we have from that bill indicates that the intent was to parallel the federal hostile work environment case law.
But do we even need to get there? What's ambiguous about it is an unfair discriminatory practice to discriminate against any person in the access to, admission to, full utilization of, or benefit from any public service because of sex?
I think the issue here, Your Honor, is that the claim here is a sexual harassment claim. Sexual harassment has a very specific definition. It's defined in the statute. It's also defined in case law. It's been defined in case law throughout. It's been incorporated into racial harassment and other types of harassment as well. And I think, to that sense, the question becomes, what is the point of having liability in an MHRA type of case, whether it's public services or employment? And the point is to hold the individual or the entity responsible for acts that occurred when there is some level of causation. So if what we're finding here is simply that there was discrimination by an employee, that is a strict liability standard. And that cannot be, based on what we've seen from Freiler, the court's understanding on this. I think instead what we see is an adoption, and what the court has done over the years is adopt two different standards that apply in these types of situations. One is the know or should have known standard, which we see, and the other is the affirmative defense standard that you see in the Freiler case for sexual harassment, which is the Farragher-Ellerith defense, which is that the individual or that the entity took reasonable care to prevent the incident from occurring, and that the individual did not take proper methods to inform about those the harassment as it occurred. And I think if we look at the case law and we look at what happened here, it's very clear that the Department of Corrections took this incredibly seriously. From the moment they found out about this, they suspended Officer Beeler. They referred it for criminal charges. What they did at that point was make sure that he could not be anywhere near any of these individuals. They let the criminal process play out. As soon as the criminal process, and they cooperated fully with the criminal process to make sure that this would happen. As soon as the criminal process played out, what they decided to do was do their own investigation. The investigation showed exactly what occurred here, which I don't think anybody is disputing is horrible and completely inappropriate, and that there is no excuse for it. I don't think the Department of Corrections and everybody else agrees with that. But what they did.
You clarify, maybe I missed it. What's the relevance to your legal argument of what happened after the incident?
So this goes to the Farragher-Ellerith, which is if you take proper remedial action after the fact, which in this case is terminating his employment, that is showing that you're taking the harassment seriously, the sexual assault seriously, and that's how you're responding to this. So there's two pieces to it. There's the know or should have known on the front end, and then there's the affirmative defense on the back end. What did you do to both prevent this from happening and take action as soon as it does?
And just to clarify your answer to Judge Riley, the reason you get the knew or should have known is because when the legislature omitted that for the employment section, it left it blank, which you're filling in with the federal law based on the statements made when the revision occurred.
Correct.
Not by what's in the body, not what in the language of the statute itself.
Correct, Your Honor.
Would you agree that is counter to our general requirement that the legislature means what it means when by the words it has and it's omitted? It's not a requirement. We would have to read into it language that wasn't added at the time of the revision.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, because I think what happens at that point, Your Honor, is that the federal case law about, and the state case law about knows or should have known applies. You can look at the Freiler case. You can look at the Goins case as well. All cases that talk about the fact that this is a standard that can be incorporated, has been incorporated in certain circumstances, and our argument is, at least as a public services standpoint, should be incorporated, as the federal court did in the Hudson case that we cite in our brief.
So what would your syllabus point be?
I think there's two syllabus points on this. The first is that the public services claim incorporates the federal standard, and a public entity is only liable for the contact or for the sexual harassment or any type of harassment if they know or should have known of the conduct. And I think the second piece to that is they are entitled to an affirmative defense if they took proper remedial action and proper actions to prevent it up front and proper remedial actions after the fact. And I think that that's the Farragher-Ellerith defense that we have in the Freiler case. I do think a couple other things, just factually, and none of this is in dispute, that is important here. There was no indication that this type of conduct would occur from Officer Beeler. He was a almost 25-year employee with a significantly positive performance record. There were no complaints ever leveled against him. The Department of Corrections does extensive training for all of its employees, including in this case Officer Beeler, about sexual harassment, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, the standards of what's expected of individuals, the issues with custodial restraint. All of those types of things were very clearly provided to this individual. And because of that, I think, and going back to the very principle, again, the MHRA is not a strict liability statute. And I think it's also important to point out the MHRA public services provision does not only apply to the Department of Corrections. It applies to anybody who provides public services. And so the idea that there should be some type of rule that applies to a corrections situation under the MHRA and not to public services in general, I think is an incorrect assumption. And I do hear that being what is being argued here. And I do think we have to look at all public services, including what the courts provide, what Metro Transit provides, what all types of public services that may be provided. And a rule that the court adopts is going to have to apply in all of those contexts, not just the correctional context. And it cannot or should not be a strict liability standard. To the extent that we've brought up, or that there's been some discussion of the Bray case, I don't think that Bray, the court explicitly decided not to address the issue in Bray. I will also, I think there's two more points I want to make sure that I cover. Judge Riley, I think you mentioned the McDonald case. I will say that the standard for sexual harassment discrimination has changed significantly from when that case was decided, I believe it was 76, to where it is now. I think that some of the language that has been adopted by the court, including the definitional language and by the legislature, argue against some of the way that that language has been applied in the past. And I don't know that that case is necessarily going to be. I think counsel did a really nice job of explaining the difference between the standard of liability for employees versus the standard of liability in general. I think it talks about the standard in general, not necessarily that vicarious liability type of idea. Finally, the court did mention official immunity. There's been this distinction that's being trying to be drawn between this idea of it's a policy, we're not challenging the policy, we're challenging the actual act of this individual. First of all, the court has been very clear that the official immunity standard does apply to the MHRA. And second, this is a situation where this is a distinction without a difference. This is whether this individual can, because what we hear, the evidence, if it goes, is going to be that they should have known that there's experts out there who are going to say that these types of things happen. Okay, I don't know how often that's going to be, but we'll accept that for right now that that's going to be the case. It still comes down to a policy determination for this entity, for the Department of Corrections, to say how much is this going to cost, what is this going to involve for the state, and because of that, we're going to have a situation where there may be one officer of one sex transporting another officer of another sex. And so in that situation, official immunity would apply. I see I've got about 30 seconds left. I want to, before I close up, see if there's any questions.
Do not appear to be any.
Okay. Well, with that, Your Honor, I would ask the court to affirm below to not create a standard of strict liability under the MHRA. And additionally, I believe that the court can affirm on the tort claims because of the differences between this case and what occurred in Sterry. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. When do you think the Supreme Court will let you know if they're going to accept PFR?
My guess, Your Honor, is that we're going to know relatively soon. But I don't know for sure.
Filed it on 412.
412, yes, Your Honor.
Your Honors, the issue of official immunity, just to clarify, the Department of Corrections is the defendant, so the official immunity works by through this doctrine of vicarious official immunity. So if the employee gets official immunity, then the employer gets to enjoy the same immunity. How can Officer Beeler get immunity in this case? And how can that immunity then vicariously flow to the state? It's just not possible. He committed an act that he knew was wrong. Official immunity would not apply under numerous cases that discuss this doctrine. And because of that, the state doesn't get vicarious official immunity because he would not be entitled to it in the first place.
I want to make sure that I'm clear procedurally. So counts 4 through 7 were the tort claims dismissed on Rule 12.
Yes.
And then you have count 3, which is the MHRA dismissed, or summary judgment was granted. And then you have general negligence, counts 8 through 9, Rule 12.
Everything got dismissed on Rule 12, Your Honor, besides the sexual harassment claim, yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Next point I want to make is this issue of statutory interpretation. As Judge Riley had pointed out, we can't get into that whole topic of reading the legislative notes and trying to figure out what the legislature wanted, because the statute is clear. That there's no ambiguity in the statute. The statute says that the public service agency is liable for acts of discrimination. And so why do we need to look to what the legislature intended or didn't intend and try to read into things that aren't written if the statute clearly says what it says? In our view, Your Honors, the statute does provide strict liability in cases of discrimination by public services agencies. And whether that's good or bad or how that's going to play out.
So you would say that the cases that Mr. Weiner cited were incorrectly decided, or what would you say?
I would say, Your Honor, that as I pointed out earlier, there are still, even under the standards that the state wants to apply, there are still exceptions for cases involving sexual harassment by supervisors. And so that case law applies here anyway. So even if the court does decide to use the federal case law for sexual harassment and does decide that some element of notice to the employer is required, there is this other body of case law within that federal standard which states that sexual harassment by supervisors is imputed to the employer. And so no matter which standard, if we apply the strict liability standard or if we apply the standard that the state advocates for, we still have liability that flows to the state because Officer Beeler was in a supervisory position over Ms. Brisson, just like any manager would be at an employment setting over a staffer at work. And I guess I'll touch briefly on the issues that counsel discussed with regards to the state tort claims. This court decided in Sterry that the common law definition of scope of employment will apply under the Tort Claims Act. And this court also decided that considering the fact that the case was dismissed under Rule 12, the case should be remanded for further discovery. The court didn't say that Mr. Sterry is going to win this case. The court simply said that we need to go back and develop the record, and it can come back on summary judgment again. Under the common law, and this is discussed in the Sterry decision, there is this Fehrendorf case that talks about the element of foreseeability. And this, again, goes not to just vicarious liability of employers, but vicarious liability of employers for acts of sexual abuse by their employees. There is this element of foreseeability that has to be satisfied in order for the case to go forward, and that's done through discovery and through expert affidavits. You have to have an expert who will testify that sexual abuse in this particular setting is a foreseeable risk of employment within this particular context. And if the plaintiff can provide such expert evidence, then you satisfy the element of foreseeability and the case can go forward. Finally, I'll say that counsel argued today that the Department of Corrections has taken extraordinary steps to make sure that these things don't happen. After Ms. Brisson's case was investigated, the Department of Corrections considered whether to change its policy, and it decided not to. So one-on-one transfers of male officers of female offenders is still allowed despite what happened to Ms. Brisson. Thank you.
Thank you for the arguments in the briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.